Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Yeah, that real estate market is scorching so hot. And it would be really helpful to have a good idea about what size mortgage you'd be approved for, or if you own, if it's wise for you to refinance, or other bits of financing facts. I'm not your person when it comes to this stuff, but I've got a person to answer these questions for you and more. Steve Kendall is the Senior Vice President of Residential and Consumer Lending at Union Bank. He's here to help us answer some home lending questions. Steve, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yes, good morning. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And listeners, if you've got a question for Steve, give us a call, 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And remember, Steve can answer general mortgage questions. He can't provide you with specific advice on your situation. So I just want to make sure you're clear on that. But he definitely can answer your questions as we navigate this half hour. So, Steve, first of all, how big a part of what you do at Union Bank are the home mortgage side?
Yeah, you know, here at Union Bank, the residential lending piece is really a core part of our community banking model and what we do. You know, it's kind of built on commercial lending and residential lending and deposit services. So yeah, residential lending is a big part of what we do.
And you've been in this area for how long? In the mortgage lending side.
Yeah, so I've been in banking now, it's over 30 years, and I've been almost all of it's in commercial or residential lending, and probably the last 18 years have been focused on residential lending.
That's great. Now, with interest rates what they are and home sales as robust as they are, can you recall a similar time that the market was like this?
No.
Oh, my.
No. When I started in banking in the late 80s, mortgage rates were probably about 13% or 14%. Today, a general 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is, somewhere around, north or south of 3%. Mm. After the Great Recession, we definitely had some time periods where rates had declined and there were these large refinance booms or waves, but rarely have we ever, tickled the 3% for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. I think this is the lowest I've ever remembered mortgage rates being.
Okay. And then on the opposite side, how hot the home the real estate sales are right now for homes. Can you recall a similar period where that was the case?
You know, it's funny. I would say actually yes. I mean, there have been times over my 30 years where the real estate market in Vermont was very, very hot. Mm-hmm. Right before the Great Recession, in the early 2000s, the market was very, very, very good. Vermont historically has struggled with inventory. It's all a supply and demand, right? If the demand is great and there's not a lot of supply, you've got more buyers chasing around a limited number of homes.
And that's what we're seeing right now. Ken, when I talk to Ken Libby, he always says, if you're thinking of selling, now's a great time because the inventory is so low and he can find a buyer for you. So when rates are this low, does it automatically follow that it's a great time to buy a home?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question, especially on the heels of the one you just asked about supply and demand, because when demand outweighs supply, right, that usually drives prices up because there's more buyers for limited homes. But with rates being as low as they are, even though home prices are appreciating, most people, conventional wisdom says, don't sit on the sidelines and wait. This, you know, get in now. So yes, it is a great time to buy right now.
All right. So it does kind of outweigh the higher home prices, those lower mortgage rates right now that are amazingly low, as you said, down there south of 3% is phenomenal for a 30-year. Let's see. Now, we got the higher home prices, lower inventory. So next thing I want to talk about is someone buying a home for the first time.
Sure.
Because I think that's probably a daunting task, you know, and prospect when someone says, okay, I think I'm ready, but I don't know if you're ever quite ready for that first purchase. So before someone applies for a loan, what are things that they should be doing, Steve?
Yeah, you know, great question, and you're so right. And those of us in the mortgage industry, you know, we have to constantly remind ourselves of that. You know, we do this every day, but, you know, people, that's, especially your first purchase, that's a really big deal. And it is. It's very daunting. You know, when we're talking to customers or prospective customers about their first home purchase, you know, we kind of give them the basics of, you know, things that you need to think about are, you know, what type of down payment you're going to have. You know, how much money are you going to be able to put into your purchase? What type of, you know, payment are you able to afford that's going to fit into your budget? You know, what's your credit history? You know, how much credit do you have? You know, do you pay your bills on time? Do you manage your debt, you know, well? How long have you been in your job, you know, or, you know, how long have you had a work history? You know, it's a big giant soup, you know, of things that we advise customers to look at. So, you know, credit history, job history, you know, monthly payment, what can you afford, and how much money do you have to put into the transaction?
Now, with an automobile purchase, it's not too much of a worry. You go shopping first for your automobile, and you figure you can get the financing, you know, pretty much buttoned up afterwards. But when you're purchasing a home, should people meet with their mortgage lender before they start their home shopping?
I strongly encourage it, and I would say probably most people in the mortgage industry definitely encourage that. If someone's dealing with a realtor, the realtor is probably going to say, hey, have you talked to your banker yet? Mm-hmm. So that we know what you're going to qualify for and we know what price range we should be looking at. Absolutely, it's always a great, great idea, and we strongly encourage that you reach out to your mortgage banker first and talk to them about your personal situation and where you're at. And, you know, it's called a pre-qual. Some people call it a pre-approval. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a preliminary running of the numbers and of the individual situation to get an idea of, you know, roughly what type of mortgage loan and what program, what dollar amount of loan and what payment they can afford to help them while they're trying to figure out which home to you know, put an offer in on.
So it definitely makes sense to find that person first to sit down with. So how does a potential home buyer, especially that first-time home buyer, establish that relationship with either a bank or someone, you know, that they choose to borrow from?
Right, right. Well, so, I'm going to be completely biased here.
But yes, please. Go ahead.
You know, I personally believe, so mortgages, in my opinion, are not a commodity. It's not just about, you know, the monthly payment and the number. It's about the relationship as well. It's about the counseling, the advice, the hand-holding, you know, whether there needs to be hand-holding or not. Understanding each customer's situation. So I'm gonna wave the local flag, you know, wave that banner back and forth all the time. I think the customers greatly benefit from dealing with any, you know, bank or mortgage company that's local. Talk to family and friends. Who did they work with? Go to your local bank. Send an email. Pick up the phone and call. Talk to someone. Find someone you're comfortable with. Find someone who understands your situation, who's willing to spend some time with you to understand your situation and what you're trying to accomplish, and not just trying to, sell you a product or sell you a payment.
Is there an advantage if I had a checking account and savings account with Union Bank, or if I financed a car previously with you? Does that work to my advantage when I come to you then to talk to you about a mortgage loan?
I'm going to say a qualified yes, because you're a known commodity, right? So, you're a known individual. You're a customer of the bank. So I think there is, I don't know if I'd use advantage, but it certainly helps establish that relationship. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Sure. I get that. We've got Pat calling from Randolph. Hi, Pat. Go right ahead.
Morning.
Hi.
I was wondering if your guests could give us an idea of how much interest rates have to change before it makes sense to refinance.
All right. So, Steve, the question about refinancing now, when does it make sense? At what rate or how long you've been in a mortgage? What do you look at to decide, what is the right time to refinance?
Well, that's a great question, and you would think the question is simple because that would have a really simple answer.
Right.
but unfortunately, it doesn't. My quick answer to that is it really depends upon how much you're going to save in your monthly payment, because you have to look at that savings amount and then figure out how much is it going to cost you to do that refinance, right? Mm-hmm. So there's also a bit of a function of the math. Right? When I said earlier, when I got into banking, I think, mortgage rates were like 11 or whatever. Mm-hmm. It used to be the rule of thumb, if rates drop 1 to 2%, then that was a good trigger to refinance. I would say those have gone by the wayside. I've seen people refinance for 0.5% or 0.75%. A lot of it's personal. A lot of it depends upon your personal situation. From a math and finance viewpoint, I always tell folks, to tell customers that, if you're refinancing so that, you can go to the summer family reunion and say that you've got the lowest rate around and want to, brag about your low rate, that's your choice. But if you're going to refinance and it's only going to save let's say $30 or $40 a month in your monthly payment, and if it's going to cost you just $3,000 to do that refinance because of, appraisals, legal fees, closing costs, and all of that, mm-hmm. right? You take that $3,000 and divide it by $30, that's how many months it's going to take you to truly benefit from that refinance. So I always tell people, don't just look at the rate. Look at what it's going to cost you to refinance. Look at what you're going to save in your monthly payment. Now, some people might say $30-$50 might be enough because that frees up some cash flow to do something else. But I guess for me, the moral of the story is just don't focus on the interest rate itself. Look at all of the picture. How long are you going to be in that home? If you're only going to be in the home for 2-3 years, right, then it probably doesn't make sense to refinance because you won't recover that cost of what it's going to cost you to refinance.
And, Steve, what if somebody, was hoping to maybe pay off the loan, the mortgage, more quickly, so they get a lower rate but then still and do it for 15 years so that they can, maybe pay the same amount they've been paying and then pay the home off in a shorter span of time. Is that something that somebody looks at when refinancing as well?
Absolutely. You are right on. There's many reasons to refinance. Shortening the term, which is what you're saying, is exactly mm-hmm. right. And there are some folks who With rates going down, they are looking at maybe they're in a 30-year or you know, maybe they have 25 years or 27 years left. Mm-hmm. And they're looking and saying, boy, you know what? I could do a 15-year mortgage, a 15-year term. And, yeah, my payment might stay the same or might even go up a tad, a little bit. But you know what? I'll have this loan paid off in half the time. So, yes, changing a term. Some people are in an adjustable rate mortgage, and they, you know, with an adjustable rate,
right,
can go up and go down. Well, they've been going down, but that doesn't mean they're going to be going down forever.
Ah.
And some people are saying maybe this is the time with rates so low to lock into a fixed rate. So
right.
I'm going to refinance so that I can be in a fixed rate. And I know that over the term, the life of this loan, that my payment is going to be and my rate are going to be exactly the same.
This brilliance is why you're here with us, Steve. Hey, let's take another call. We've got Tim in Morrisville. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
What's your question?
So my question is, I'm with your bank. I've been with your bank for about 5 years. And your credit rating to get a loan is kind of high. It all of a sudden went up higher. I'm at like 620.
So the personal credit score for someone, how do you determine that, Steve, you know, for giving someone a loan or a mortgage?
Yep. Well, first of all, Tim, thanks for your business. We greatly appreciate that. Credit history, you know, credit scores. You know, I've been in banking long enough that I remember when there weren't credit scores. Bankers would look at a customer's payment history. You'd pull a credit report, and you'd look at all the places that a customer had debts, you know, and you'd look at the amount of debt they had. You look at how recent the debt was had, how many inquiries, you know, new debts that they've taken on, the payment history, all of those things. Well, that's what these credit scores do, is they take all of these factors and they have this, you know, double top secret probation black box that they put all this information into.
The algorithm.
Exactly. And this credit score number comes out. Now, what I'll tell you is at Union Bank, we don't lend based on credit score. We do it the old way. We do it based upon the credit history. Now, that said, if someone does have a credit score that, you know, credit scores do match up with those risk factors.
Right.
So I will tell you, we don't use credit score as a reason to either approve or deny a loan. We look at what's behind that credit score. Have we done loans with credit scores such as 620 or lower? Yes, we have. Have there been compensating factors or reasons to explain why that credit score and credit history was what it was? Absolutely. So I don't know, Tim, if I'm really – I'm not sure I got to your question. I want to make sure I'm giving you an answer to what you're asking.
Tim, did you have a follow-up?
I'm trying to find out who I should go to get a mortgage then because, you know, I make good money. I make plenty of money. This was past history problems before. I've raised my credit from 560 to 620. I mean, I all my bills are paid on time and everything, and it's like, what can I do and who do I go to?
Right. And so, I mean, it sounds like you're doing the right things, Tim. You're on the right track. And, you know, when we have a situation when we're talking with a customer and if we can't help them at that time, that, you know, typically what we'll tell them is, you know, try not to take on any new debts. Pay all your bills on time, you know, and come back and see us in, you know, 6 to 12 months. You know, check in every 6 months, and then we can reevaluate where you're at and see if you're at a point where we can move forward. So I don't know the last time you spoke to someone, whether it be at Union Bank or any bank, but, you know, based upon what you're telling me, go ahead.
I spoke to Sherry at Morrisville, and she said she couldn't help me at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if that was, you know, a week ago, 6 months ago, or a year ago, but, you know, based upon what you're doing, I'd say, you know, reach out to her again.
All right. Okay. Tim, thanks for that question. And, hopefully we can get that settled for Tim. That would be a great outcome of today's show. I do want to ask you, Steve, we talked about first time borrowers, for first-time home buyers. And I'm wondering if they always need that 20% down payment for the home.
That's a really great question, because that is typically, you know, one of the perceived stumbling blocks. Mm-hmm. And what I will say is, no, they don't have to have 20% down. There are many programs out there that will help first-time home buyers who don't have that 20%. You know, in general, I would say if a borrower can at least get 3 to 5%, then they probably, and if they have, you know, good credit and job history and you know, their income is solid, then there's a good chance they can get into a conventional loan, but they'll need private mortgage insurance, which is just like any other insurance. You're paying to insure a lender to take on that risk that the borrower doesn't have that 20% down payment. And I'll quickly say that even if a borrower has no down payment at all, there are government programs, especially for low to moderate income folks. The USDA Rural Development Program has a program that a borrower can get into a home with no money down, and the loan is guaranteed by the USDA Rural Development. So, you know, Vermont Housing Finance Agency has some down payment assistance grants and funds that are available, as does the Federal Home Loan Bank. So, you know, if someone doesn't have a down payment or is worried about the down payment, you know, going to any of the home ownership centers, there's one in every region in Vermont, or, as I said, go talk to your banker, go talk to your mortgage banker and ask them and say, but not having a down payment would not be a reason not, too many knots there, sorry. you know.
Yeah, don't let that be the barrier, so.
Right, exactly. It's go talk to somebody. There's ways to do it. There's programs out there.
That's fantastic. Steve Kendall is the Senior Vice President of Residential and Consumer Lending at Union Bank. Steve, I really appreciate, as our listeners do, that you provided so many answers this morning for us. Thanks so much.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you so much for this opportunity. Take care now.
You too. Next up is CBS News, and then we head to Northfield and stop in at a great artisan crafts and art gallery. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. For the next hour, we're going to speak with a couple people in the arts. And this next guest was suggested by a WDEV listener who thought this would be perfect for the show. Please keep those suggestions coming in. Finding all the different elements and people that make this state so rich is what I love to highlight on the show. So we're headed now to Northfield to Art Etc. It's a Vermont-made artisan crafts and art gallery. The owner is Andrea Melville, and she joins us now. Andrea, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Listeners, if you've got a question for Andrea or if you've had a chance to visit her gallery, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Andrea, tell us exactly what Art Etc. is.
Oh, we are a sun-filled, cozy artisan craft and art gallery space located right on Depot Square, facing south, in the heart of downtown Northfield. We have, oh gosh, it varies a little bit from month to month, but 20 to 25 different artisan crafters, different potters, candle makers, blacksmiths, bird carver, basket maker, different types of wood crafters, of course, photographers, 2D artists, jewelers. I'm probably leaving a lot out here. But that's
I think there's even soap makers in there.
There's soap and lotion, yes. It's nice to just come in and smell.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, you had me at sun-filled and cozy before you even brought the art and artisan crafts in there. Why and when did you decide to create this place, Andrea?
Well, it was, 2018. And I was trying to think about what I would like to do for the next phase of my life. And I knew I really wanted to be able to walk to work. I happened to live in Northfield because I had commuted up and down 89 for so many years and beyond. And I just thought it'd be nice to be local. So in December, the town of Northfield often has a community event called the Common Spirits, when there's a tree lighting and singing, and sometimes Santa arrives. And this particular December, there was also a farmer's market and some artisan crafters on Depot Square set up under their little tents and all. But it also happened to be, I think, the coldest night ever in December.
Ever.
Some Norwich cadets had mini bonfires going on the square to try to keep us warm. But I remember going into Carrier Roasting, good plug for them, coffee store, trying to drink something hot to keep us warm. And I remember looking out over at the depot, and I just had those aha moments, and it was those crafters need a home. So I had gone to a lot of, you know, craft fairs that always happen around the state in December, and collected up a stack of business cards from artisans that I just love their work. And in January, I took a 13-week small business class with the Women's Small Business Program at Mercy Connections in Burlington. And then there happened to be a space available, although stars were aligning properly. In April, signed the lease and moved into this wonderful storefront. And with the help of my family, we spackled and painted and did all kinds of needed updating, electrical work, put in track lighting for our gallery spaces. And then we actually opened our doors mid to end of June of 2019.
Well, Andrea, what does a gallery, having a gallery and a shop of this sort, add to Northfield?
That gives me goosebumps every time I say this, but for the a couple times a week for at least the first 6 months that we were open, people would just walk in the door and stand at the door and look around and just say, this is exactly what Northfield needs. And it just makes me so happy to, you know, be able to bring the amazing work. I mean, out of our 20, 25 artists that we have, I want to say at least 75% of them are from within 10, 15 miles of the store. Wow. I mean, there's so much talent and beauty that these people produce. And so if, you know, someone is on their lunch break, and even if they just pop in to enjoy the beauty, the smells, think about, oh, my sister's got a birthday coming up in a couple months. You know, I want to keep this in mind. If they just come in to just take a breath and put the world aside, especially nowadays, it just makes me so happy.
Well, we'll do this a few times during this half hour, but I want you to take us around the shop and maybe show us a few things, maybe a couple things from those local artists that you've mentioned.
Love to.
You got something for us?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Right when you come in the door, I have, let's see, 1, 2, 5 jewelers that are here with me right now. Some from coming off of December and Valentine's Day, of course. Mm-hmm. So that rotates. We have a jeweler that works in Cork, which is sort of the vegan-friendly, non-leather type thing. Interesting bracelets and earrings. I have had a stained glass artist in earlier, and he also does earrings, so glass earrings. Mm-hmm. Silver and gold, beautiful baubles. We have, let's see, 1, 2, 3 potters here right now between mugs and bowls and pour-over coffee pot and his compost, beautiful compost pots for sitting on your kitchen counter, lamps. One potter did a bread cloche, especially during the pandemic when everyone was making bread. It's like its own self-contained oven with a lid.
Oh, I love it.
Again, just a beautiful piece of work.
What would you say is the most unique craft of any of your artisans?
That's a great question. And, you know, it kind of, I think it varies a little bit with the season. Although I'm looking at one of my woodworkers has made, he has taken wood, maple, sorry, most of it raised right here in town. And he was able to purchase a lot of old style, although many people still use them, sap tap spouts.
Right.
So he's made like a coat rack, or it could be for, you know, hats and dog leashes, with these sap taps attached to, you know, a maple board, which is pretty Vermont-y, unique.
Oh, indeed.
Beautiful tables are pretty unique, and I'd say any of the pottery. My blacksmith makes these, which were actually popular last week, these adorable heart-shaped that are hand forged. I have some felted. Artist creates, does felting with lovely, mindful, kind of inspirational subjects. One says daily steps of courage and feel the love and just happiness.
Well, I'm speaking with Andrea Melville. Now, some people, you mentioned driving up I-89. Some listeners will probably remember you from your past life or career. So tell people about what you did before art, et cetera.
I've always been a visual artist in a sense. Some people walk in here and say, so is all this work yours? And it's like, yeah, no, I don't have that talent.
Oh, say
but,
yes.
yeah, right. I was a television producer and independent documentary producer as well for quite a while. And my work is still aired on Vermont PBS. I think New Hampshire Public Television, my docs have aired on Maine Public Broadcasting, so quite, a New England base. But my mother was an artist, and actually some of her easels and prints are actually here. Mm. So that's nice to have her here. And I think that's just my whole, visual images and how to lay things out is just in me.
Yeah. We received this email from Paula, who says that you have amazing shows in your gallery there. So, Andrea, it's time to tell us about what happens there.
Yeah. So thank you, Paula, for that question. So I have two gallery spaces, one in the front room and a sort of a cozier space in the back. I must add that I'm in a somewhat historic building, so I have 12-foot ceilings.
Mm.
So it's really nice to be able to have lots of wall space available to me.
It was just waiting for you to move in with your art.
The stars were there.
Yeah.
So when we were talking, if we'll talk pre-COVID, so these two gallery spaces would host two different artists. And then at the beginning of each month, usually a Friday night, we would have wonderful opening receptions for the community to come and meet the artists, have a little bit of local beer and wine and cheese. And it was just such a wonderful gathering space for people to meet the artists, to come in and see what's new. We would often have musicians. So it was a great I'm looking forward to having them back, but it's just a nice, cozy in the winter. You know how sometimes we lock ourselves away in the winter time because of the weather, and people would come out, December of 19, it was snowing like crazy and the common spirit, was going on. And people were just coming in and out and just seeing old friends and, you know, having a glass of something is just so much fun. So I have still kept up, at least with changing out the artists. Now it's more so every artist come in for 2 months at a time.
Okay.
But like I said, you know, certainly looking forward to those days when we can welcome people back in. And can I take a moment to tell you about the current exhibit?
You better. That was my next question.
So, like I said, I pulled from, the artists in these galleries have been 2D artists. I've had fiber artists April and May. I've got a sort of a multimedia artist that's going to bring in some music with his work. So a collective of all different types of work. But the exhibit that is up now for February and March is student work from right here at the Northfield High School. And last September, they, through their U.S. history course, read the book The Hate U Give, and were asked to produce either something artistic, either something poetry-related or visual art. And so 19 pieces were created artistically and covered with safety plastic, weatherproof type of thing, and they were put on stakes around another one of our gems, the Dog River Park, that opened just a few years ago. So it was like a little walking tour. Well, unfortunately, a few days later, all but two pieces had been vandalized. But before that event occurred, the administration had taken photographs, happily, of each piece. So they have now been copied and enlarged, really a poster form, and all 19 of them are now here in the store, in the gallery spaces for everyone to enjoy, because they were up for such a short amount of time, most community members were not able to go experience the originals, but happily, and it certainly timed out well with Black History Month this month, everyone can come in and enjoy them.
Oh, that's great. Now, you mentioned that you can't have the opening receptions in the galleries now like you had pre-pandemic, but what else has changed, you know, since March for you there?
Well, we were closed, you know, under Governor Scott's orders for, it was a good 2 months-ish or so. And then, even then when we were able to open, and I certainly understand this because I felt the same way, that, you know, many people were not quite ready to venture out But then happily with summer, you know, community members started to come around. You know, unfortunately with the various shutdowns and regulations, you know, Norwich University, be it the students or faculty, staff, administration, were, you know, certainly supporters and continue to be as much as they can. But a lot of those people aren't around. You know, families aren't dropping off their kids and coming downtown to, you know, have a meal or just check out downtown. And you know, Darntoff is pretty much closed a lot as well. So that has been, as with, you know, so many other small businesses around the state as well. But the local community's been amazing. I did, I remember for Mother's Day last year in May, before we had opened, you know, people were calling in and just looking on my Instagram page saying, oh, I like this particular item, you know, can you ship it to me? And, or we do curbside. And so we just, everyone, you know, everyone has just made it work. And I so appreciate everyone's continued support. It's been great. And your show is helpful as well. So we're all taking baby steps and being very understanding and appreciative of everyone.
It seems like this is the case, that Northfield is really important to you. Why is that?
Oh, let's see. When my husband and I bought our house here, it was because he was working in Lebanon at the time, and I was in Colchester, and we were exactly 50 miles in opposite directions door to door of our work. So that was kind of cool. But then I later learned my grandmother was born here, and I have my great-great, I want to say, grandfather was president of Norwich. So and my father went to Norwich, so I always told him he never had a reason to miss alumni events because of living here. So, you know, it's when things are meant to happen, they do. And it's just really been a pleasure and to try to be more involved with the community on even on just simple levels.
And we've got about a minute left, but I'm going to put you in charge of the Chamber of Commerce. I usually get there for the Cabot Sox sale, which didn't happen this year. So make your pitch to people why they should come to Northfield and visit.
Well, I want everyone to support local businesses and certainly artisan stores around the state. We are all different, have different artists, you know, unique in different ways. I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the artists that I have currently are extremely local. A lot of their products are made, like I said, the woodworking comes off of land right here in Northfield. So it's just, I just have different artists. Then they do unique different things for everyone to enjoy.
Andrea Melville is the owner of Art Etc. in Northfield. It's a Vermont-made artisan crafts and art gallery, and you can check them out at artetcvt.com. Andrea, I want to thank you so much for being on Vermont Viewpoint today.
Thank you, Rick. This was really fun.
All right, great. For me, too. We're going to take a break now for CBS News, and then we're going to head to the White River Junction area and learn about JAG Productions. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. From the visual arts last half hour, we now shift to the performing arts this half hour. For the past few years, I've been reading about a special theater company in White River Junction, but have never had an opportunity to speak with anyone there about the work they're doing. Well, this week they've got a big event coming up, and I decided that it was time for me and all of you to learn about JAG Productions. Joining us now is their producing artistic director, Jarvis Green. Jarvis, thank you for patiently waiting for me to finally contact you to hear the story of JAG Productions.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thanks for reaching out.
Sure thing. Listeners, if you have a question for Jarvis or if you've enjoyed a production of JAG's, you can give us a call, 244-1777, or toll-free 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. First of all, Jarvis, what is JAG Productions?
JAG Productions is a theater company based in White River Junction. We're going into our fifth season. We produce classic, contemporary, and new works. So all of our stories, the mission of the organization is to bring more compassion, empathy, and love into the world by telling stories that challenge hierarchies of race, gender, class, and sexuality. All of our stories are written by, they are told by, and they are for Black, brown, queer, and trans folks and the people that love them.
When and why did you form the theater company?
I started the company in 2016 with our first production. We did a production of Choir Boy by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who is a MacArthur-winning playwright. He's the head of the playwriting program at Yale. And the play was recently on Broadway, I think two seasons ago. But I started the company because of, my own kind of personal interest in telling more nuanced, varied, a myriad of like stories that can be told through the lens of the African-American experience. Mm-hmm. I am a theater artist myself. I'm a culture worker. I started my career working as a professional actor in regional theaters across the country. And I was always kind of moved by how theater making reflects our humanity. And I was often kind of displeased with the American theater and the lack of stories that reflected my life as well as other folks' lives. I think that when I think about the American theater and stories that are told that kind of reflect the diaspora, they're sort of limited stories that have been like produced and told. So I started the company to kind of like change that and to produce stories and make stories that I loved and stories that reflected my own life and stories that like challenged me and as an artist, as a humanitarian. That's why I started the company.
Well, Jarvis, 5 years down the road, you know, it sounds kind of easy. I started this company. But, you know, to go from zero to, you know, 60 in a short amount of time and to break new ground had to be extremely difficult. There had to be hurdles. So how does one get a theater company up and going like you did with JAG Productions?
Yeah, I theater making is such a collaborative experience. I think that you need community. You need folks that have a desire and a love for art making, and also that have a love for storytelling, and that want and that need to hear different perspectives and different voices, are interested in exploring ways to connect with the community through telling stories. So because it takes such a collaborative experience, I was in conversations with a lot of various people within the community to talk about the work, to build. I think that, like, when you're a startup, you know, organization, a lot of the work relies heavily on, you know, the founder and, you know, the artistic director. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of work for, like, building community and maintaining relationships. So not only does it take a lot of maintaining relationships and transparency, you know, you have to raise money and you have to connect with philanthropists and find ways of you know, bringing money into the organization from various different revenue streams. So, you know, I have a board of directors with a nonprofit organization. I have a couple staff members. And, you know, those folks are my tribe. I think of our donors as our tribe as well. Like, right. I mean, we have everything from, you know, folks that donate $5 a month to folks that can do like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 like a year, mm-hmm. Various different foundations. So it's about your network, and that's how I've been able to do the work and what's sort of getting into this place of really being sustainable and becoming, you know, a pillar in the community.
Yeah. And so it sounds like you have been accepted and really fostered by both the theater community and the community overall.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, it's before I started JAG, I was doing work in various other nonprofit organizations. So who I am as a person, as a art maker, that was all, that groundwork was already laid. So people knew who I was. And then when I started JAG, it was just kind of an addition to what I had already kind of given our community.
What have been the highlights so far over the first 5 years for JAG?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the highlights was that we have a New Works Play Festival every year called JAG Fest, where we invite 30 to 50 artists to the, you know, to the snowy mountains of Vermont to develop new plays. And one of the plays that was brought to our festival, JAG Fest 2.0, we partnered with a theater company by the name of Trevelyan Theater in New York City, and did the world premiere of the play. So, like, when the work is happening at JAG Fest, it's sort of bare bones. It's a reading. The work is still being developed. And then when, you know, 2 years after that, we were able, in 2019, we were able to bring that show fully onto the stage with mm-hmm. another theater company in New York. And then, you know, we were in rehearsals for the show in New York when the pandemic hit. And so we've had to indefinitely postpone the show. So that was both a highlight and also a really kind of, you know, sad, you know, moment, because, you know, we haven't been able to get back into the theater.
Jarvis, why is theater, or is it, a good medium to break down barriers and hopefully unite us?
Well, I think that, one, there's something, like, beautiful about gathering, right? For a moment, we all get to escape together for 2.5 hours. The lights go down. We're not looking at racial demographics, socioeconomic demographics. Like, in that moment, we are having a shared experience in a space. And hopefully, if the art and if the storytelling does its job, then, like, that entire audience, whether it's 10, 20, 200, 300, 400, 500, that entire audience gets to have that experience together and get to go on this journey with these characters and with these people collectively together. So I think that's why play theater is so important, and I'm always, like, kind of amazed at how, when we are in a theater space, when there is that work that goes right to the heart you know, and less about how we're kind of intellectualizing the piece. Like when you have that sort of emotional, visceral response to the work, right? Like that, for that moment, you extend beyond yourself and have empathy for another. I think that's how theater breaks down those barriers. And you get to see who those people are, their backgrounds, their insecurities, their highs, their lows. Like, you know, oftentimes those are our kind of singular experience that we get to have. Oftentimes, if you're lucky, you get to have it with your partner and family. But still, those experiences are just kind of like your own. And in that moment, you kind of get to go beyond your own life into another person's world.
With live theater more than any other kind of arts, I wish afterwards we could just hermetically seal the theater for an hour so we can all just talk about what we just experienced, right? Mm-hmm. It just feels like I don't want to leave. Even if I'm with somebody else, I don't want to just talk about it with one. I want to talk about it with everyone who just experienced what they just saw.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned
– I thought
– go ahead.
Yeah, I find that to be during East Side's Table, because there was a lot of people had a lot of that visceral kind of experience watching the play. And oftentimes, like, people would just sit for half hour in the theater, just sitting, maybe talking to their partner. We also, like, set up the space in our lobby where people can just, like, hang out for as long as they need to kind of process the work, talk about their work, to build community. And I had never worked on a piece where that experience was so, like, profound for people, where they needed it to, they're like, I can't just, like, walk out of the theater as if I just didn't, like, you know, get moved in a way that, like, shifted my perspective about how I'm thinking about the themes in this play.
Jarvis, you mentioned the space in the theater. Does JAG have its own theater?
No, we don't have our own theater. We work out of Briggs Opera House, which is a really kind of cool 240-seat thrust theater. Northern Stage was in the space before they built their new building. So that's what we've been operating out of.
Oh, that's excellent. And what kind of outreach programs do you do usually in a non-COVID year to provide for area students?
Yeah, so we haven't been able to, I think, like, an education arm of JAG has been something that I've been really thinking about recently. And, you know, we're still a very small organization, and so being able to kind of, like, bring on an education director to kind of build some, like, robust programming for students is something that we're going to be thinking about in our planning for our next fiscal year. But when we were in production, like, we offer free student matinees for students. So folks, you know, I go out and do some fundraising and offer free student matinees to schools all over the state. And, you know, if we have, like, a 6-week run, we have a Wednesday matinee at 10 o'clock. And, you know, we get busloads of students. We fill up the theater, have talk back with the artist and myself with the students. And generally, like, we send a pretty extensive packet of information from our dramaturge, who will then kind of break down the themes and the ideas and the conversations, sort of centering around the piece, that teachers get to have this information and be in conversation with the students before they come to the theater.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, you mentioned earlier JAGFest, and I think it was JAGFest 2. Are you up to JAGFest 5 this year? Is that where we're at?
Yeah, we're up to JAGFest 5.0. It's kind of crazy. I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, so, you know, this year when gathering isn't possible, we have a lineup of radio plays, which is very exciting. We have 10 to 20 minute radio plays that we recorded and will be released on Friday. So 6 playwrights, 6 directors, a company of 12 actors. We spent a week of rehearsing on Zoom, which was kind of a scheduling nightmare.
Oh my God.
6 different plays kind of rehearsing on Zoom. And like Zoom has this thing where you can only have like 3 rooms running at one time. And so our production manager had to like have another Zoom account, so that we can rehearse the other plays. And, so we rehearsed all of these plays. Not only am I producing the festival, I directed one of the pieces, and I acted in one of them as well.
Oh, man.
So, rehearsing on Zoom, I don't recommend it. It's like, it's a lot, you know? I mean, because my work is on Zoom so much now. But the great thing was, is like, we just kind of decided that, like, since the platform is audio, like, let's turn off our cameras and really just, like, listen. And so, I'm very excited. I think, folks can still buy tickets to the podcast. Tomorrow night, we're going to be doing a panel conversation with the artists at the Hopkins Center. They have a program called Hop at Home. So we will do a live streaming panel conversation with the Hop, with the artistic director of the National Black Theater in Harlem, who's one of our directors. Sharifa Ali, who's also one of our directors and a couple actors. And so we'll be in conversation tomorrow night. I'll be moderating that conversation. We're also kind of releasing to our ticket buyers like a behind-the-scenes video of just like showing us like in rehearsal and a conversation between my co-producer and I that we're kind of releasing to our ticket buyers. And then on Friday, the links to the podcast will be on the website. It's a really great lineup of artists. You have folks that like the artistic director of the National Black Theater in Harlem. You have you have folks that recently had shows that are off Broadway. You have folks that are wrote a play that was a thesis from graduating college. So it's like it's a really nice mix of artists.
And Jarvis, explain exactly what a radio play is.
A radio play is an audio play. So these playwrights, we commissioned them to write a play that was simply for audio. There is a little bit of a soundscape. The entire play, like you can listen in home, a story about some characters that will have sound effects and various different things. So you'll be able to kind of like hear, and the sound effects also kind of help you kind of visualize like the world, that was created for the medium. Radio plays have, they started a while back, and it's been really nice to kind of time travel a little bit by working in this way, and on this platform. So that's what the radio play is about. It's just simply put, it's a play that is meant to be listened to.
Well, one I'm really intrigued by is called For the Love of Jazz. So tell us a little bit about that one.
Oh, that's great. Raven Cassell, For the Love of Jazz, is a play about a young writer who falls in love with a jazz musician. It happens during the Harlem Renaissance. And so what I love about the play, I'm excited actually about the full length. Like, there's scenes in it that that the characters are sort of like acting out what the moment is about. And then there's a lot of narration in between to kind of move the story forward. Like if it was a full length play, like all of that work would be like acted out.
Mm-hmm.
But the playwright has sort of added this narrative for this platform to kind of, move the story forward. So it's a really piece. I think that like it has a really interesting tempo. Like the dialogue is poetic and fast. This character Blue, who's the main character, who's this like young writer, is a feisty, very interesting character. And then, you know, she falls in love with this like kind of cool, slick jazz musician. So I really think they're going to love that piece.
That's so great. You've come so far in 5 years, JAG Productions. What are the plans you have for the future of the theater company?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've been talking about a space and what's possible for a space. I think that internally, you know, being a managing director for us is like the next kind of big step internally, so that we can kind of continue our growth. And then, you know, I think that we've created a really kind of cool template right now for work, like having world premieres, JAG Fest. I've been thinking, I have an idea to develop a program to reimagine classic American musicals through the lens of the African American experience. So I'm like starting to develop that program and then eventually start producing imagine classic American musicals. But I think that, like, you know, I've done that work to kind of get us in a place where we can kind of like ride out what has been created for a little bit and see how that works. And so those are the kind of like plans that we have now, right? Like just keeping up with the template that we have, jazz works, want to continue to develop relationships with other theater companies and doing co-production. I've been in conversations with the Flynn to figure out ways at which we can kind of work together. The same goes for the Dartmouth Theater Department, really starting to kind of build a relationship between the two companies to see what's possible. So there's a lot there's a lot on our plates right now, but I think that like The big things is like the idea of a space and getting a managing director.
Outstanding. Jarvis Green is the producing artistic director of JAG Productions. And to learn more about the company and the upcoming evening of radio plays on love stories, the website is jagproductionsvt.com. jagproductionsvt.com. Jarvis, I want to thank you for being on with me, especially during this very busy week. So thanks a lot.
Of course. Goodbye.
All right, take care. We're going to pop out for a CBS News break and then come back, and we'll open up the phones. Plus, I've done my homework. I have an answer for a listener who has called in twice this week with a question, so you'll hear that shortly. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Well, I almost got a full show for you today. We'll try again tomorrow. But when I come up short, of course, that gives you the opportunity to call in with your interesting stories or your puzzling questions or your well-thought-out points of view. So the phones are open until 11. Feel free to call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can let me know about something in the arts you've enjoyed. You can ask me a question and probably not get the answer. You can ask my opinion on politics and definitely not get a satisfactory answer. We talked NEK yesterday. You can share a Kingdom memory or your favorite site up there or anywhere in the state. Music, books, some project you've taken up during the pandemic. I'd love to hear about it. It's your opportunity, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So phone's wide open for the next so many minutes, and looks like we got our leadoff hitter. You know, he was down in the order where somebody beat Fred in the other day, and he was the second caller in, so he's going to be number one on our list today. Freddie, go right ahead. What are you going to confuse me with today?
What am I going to watch you today?
Confuse me with.
Oh, come on now.
What do you got?
Hey, look, this is, you know, I was listening to Joe last night. He says he's going to spend big.
Joe Biden, yep.
Yeah, right. He's going to spend big. And
that's right.
Going to have to increase that. He's going to have to increase taxes to spend big. You know, this is it's going to be a total disaster. You got to look at the economic situation right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a stagnant economy. We have an economy that's got almost no growth to it.
Right.
But the thing that's the real killer now is look at commodity prices. Gasoline is going up. Oil's going up. Soybeans are going up. Lumber's going up. All these commodity prices are going up. And with a low economic growth and high commodity prices, you get the worst possible scenario, and it's called stagflation. Stagflation is it's the most difficult thing to get out of,
mm-hmm.
because you have an economy that's weak, and you have commodity prices that affect everybody, like bread and butter and milk. Really, this is going to be so exciting.
Well, Fred, I'm going to put you in charge of that stagflating economy. Now, how do you get it restarted?
Well, that's the hard part. That's even the economists that think about this all the time say stagflation is the worst thing that you can deal with because it's so hard to get out of. The economy is not producing right now. And if the economy is not producing and prices are going up, I mean, the future is a disaster.
But don't you goose the economy to get it rolling again?
Don't you what the economy?
Goose it.
Yeah, by putting money into it. And if you put money into the economy, you're going to inflate the prices even worse. I mean, it's crazy.
So don't put money into the economy, and we'll get through it without money into the economy.
Well,
I'm just asking. I'm putting you in charge. You don't like Joe's approach. What is the right approach?
Well, the right approach is it's above my pay grade because all the economists got PhD degrees. They're saying, it's getting close to above my pay grade, too.
All right. Thanks, Fred, for that. All right. Stagflation. What do we do to get out of it? That's our first topic of the morning, but it's wide open, whatever you'd like to talk about. We talked about concerts last week. You still have a memory to share. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Now, the last couple of days, Wade had called in from Moortown. He called in after our Vermont Cheese Show. And again, you could share a great Vermont cheese if you want to. But Wade called in with a question, and I mused an answer. He called in yesterday to see if I had done my homework to get the right answer. I had not. So then last night I decided, oh, yeah, I still have Wade's homework assignment. And what Wade called about after the cheese show was, he heard about making energy from wastewater from the cheese process. And so I said, well, I think you can use that in a biodigester, and that is how you would make energy from the wastewater from the cheese process. Well, I looked it up last night, and it almost feels like I had Wade call in to ask me the question, and I pretended to not know. I really didn't know. I just was trying my best to answer him. Turns out I'm right. So here's an article I found. There's an Alpine power station that's using the region's famous cheese in an unexpected way to generate enough electricity to supply power for a community of 1,500 people. I sure hope Wade in Moortown is listening to this. In Albertville, so some of us might remember Albertville, France, which is where the Winter Olympics have been held. They use whey, a byproduct left over from the production of the town's famous Beaufort cheese. Whey is the liquid that is released from the curds during the cheese-making process. Remember, who was it? Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet eating her curds and whey. So that's released, and it's the same liquid that often rises to the top of yogurt products. Mostly water, but it also contains things like proteins and milk sugars. And so the process of making cheese results in a lot of residual whey. For every pound of cheese, a producer is normally left with about a gallon of whey. So when bacteria is added to whey, they can begin to digest the sugars. That, in turn, produces methane. I hope I haven't lost anybody. I can just hear people snoozing. But this is for one listener in particular, Wade, but I think we all learn from it. Okay, so it produces methane, the biogas that can be captured and used as fuel. In Albertville, that methane is then fed through a machine that heats water to 194 degrees Fahrenheit, which in turn generates electricity. Can you believe this? I was right. The power station, which opened in October, was designed and built by a Canadian company, Valbio, which specializes in turning organic waste into methane biogas. And here's the deal. Whey left over from the cheese-making process, as I mentioned, a lot is produced, but it's not an easy product to dispose of. It's high in phosphorus and nitrogen. It can't be dumped into water sources like fertilizers. An excess of whey could lead to things like dead zones and algal blooms, and we know all about them. We know all about the algae, the green algae blooms in Lake Champlain. So we don't want to be dumping the whey wastewater into the water stream. What do we do with it? Put it in a biodigester and create electricity. And so there we have it. Wastewater from the cheese process turned into energy. And I mused that that was the basic idea of how to do it when Wade has asked. And believe it or not, I would have gotten about maybe an 80 on my essay answer if I was in some kind of biology class. So you got the basic idea. I just didn't have the general chemistry correct. But Wade, I hope you're listening. I hope you hear that. And we've got Jim on the line from Barrie. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Last week I called about the concerts, the different concerts
yes.
we've been to, and I had told about how my nephews were listening to the same band 30 years later.
That's right.
That I was listening to. Well, I thought I'd call and tell you the rest of the story and how we came about knowing that we both listened to the same bands.
Excellent.
When I was in high school, the same time I went to see most of these concerts, I was dating this girl from Wilmington, Mass. And she babysat for a neighbor who happened to be a Wilmington cop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Who was in Boston at some point and had all their equipment stolen. And this cop in Wilmington, Mass. Busted a house in Wilmington and found all the Who's equipment and gave it back to him.
Wow.
So the Who gave this guy, the Who said to him, or the Who manager, said to him, you know, would like to have you guys come to a concert. Do you have kids or whatever? And he said, well, my kids are little. But he said, my babysitter would love to go. So they gave us a bunch of tickets. And we went to see The Who in the Boston Tea Party.
Oh, yeah.
With myself, my girlfriend, her brother, his girlfriend, and the two little kids that she babysat for, and the cop and his wife. And after the concert, we were brought back, and we had our picture taken with all of us with The Who.
Oh, man.
Fast forward 30 years, and I'm at my sister's house down in Windsor, and my nephews, who at the time were 18 to 20, came across this colored Polaroid picture of myself with The Who, and they're flipping out. They're going, Uncle Jimmy, this is The Who. How can you get with The Who? I was like, how do you know The Who? He said, we all know The Who. And that's how it all came about. But anyway, I remember being shocked that they even knew who they were, let alone they recognized their picture even. But it was 30 years later, and they were still talking about The Who, and then, of course, Led Zeppelin came up in the conversation or whatever. But
wow. That
was the rest of the story.
Well, Jim, I think you should have told them that you had to fill in as the drummer, you know, after they lost Keith Moon, that, you know, you had a brief stint with The Who, you know.
Yeah,
you got to embellish the story.
I did play the drums actually in high school, but I was never that level. All right, I thought I'd tell you the rest of the story. Thanks.
Hey, that is a great story. Thanks, Jim. All right. That's Jim with his story about The Who. We were talking concerts last week. If you want to share one, if you were able to see any during the pandemic, or if you had some tickets wiped out that you weren't able to see, I want to pass along, since he brought up a concert in Boston, I went and saw the person who this documentary is about, and really think if you love music, you really love this documentary. Someone suggested to me once, and I kind of poo-pooed it, and then a second person who I really respect, their musical taste, told me about it, and I rented it and became a massive fan of it. It's been out since 2012, but it's called Searching for Sugar Man. And if you don't know anything about it, it's this little-known artist in Detroit back in the 70s. And just to give you the bare bones of the story, you know, the album didn't do much, although the music is really quite interesting. He was this local legend in Detroit, put a couple albums out, but one winds up in South Africa. And Sugar Man becomes bigger than Elvis in South Africa. And I know it sounds like, you know, kind of a hokey fiction, but it's true. It's a great documentary, Searching for Sugar Man, great music, and really highly recommend it if you're looking for something to watch and you love music. He is kind of Dylan-esque in a way, but, you know, not Bob Dylan at all. But give it a shot, Searching for Sugar Man. All right, we've got wide open phones, and I'm not going to reread the energy-making process from cheese water, but I am going to read some blotter tales. So I love the Times Argus police blotter. They do one for both Barrie and Montpelier, and they're quite entertaining. But this blotter comes from the Boston Globe. And so it takes, you know, the basics of what you read in the Times Argus. And, you know, now you're in a major metropolitan. And so I'm just going to read a few until you start calling here, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. So let's see. This one was a woman. Police were dispatched to Briarwood Avenue after an elderly resident called to report that a person in a silver car rang her doorbell and left a box that said free pizza. According to the log entry, the resident thought this was suspicious and asked for the officer to check the box out further. And then the officer was sent to document the incident, and it was just an empty box of pizza. So I'm sure some young pranksters, probably me and, you know, my high school buddies, would have done this, put a box. It was totally harmless. But there's some good ones. Another time in Peabody, police heard from a man on Long Street Road. These all happened in the same week, by the way. Who said a man driving a small yellow pickup truck came into his property, offered his child candy through the window. An officer spoke to the child and the mother and learned that there was no truth to the youngster's story. The child apparently dreamt this situation, and it didn't actually occur. And so the mother showed the officer the video footage. It was a yellow city pickup truck that had passed by the house. And so this kid saw the yellow truck and then had a dream about the guy stopping, offering candy. But it did not happen. So police, again, called out on these really incredible calls in the Boston area. I hope these have bored you to the point where you're dialing right now to make me stop. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And that's kind of my best material, and I'll keep going until we get a call from West Braintree. And believe it or not, we've got one. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I've been trying to call in for quite a while. I just don't get time to it. The only place I can get you is on my truck radio. But
all right.
I want to make several comments here.
Okay.
On this thing that happened down in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
in January 6th, it was,
yeah.
This so-called resurrection.
Yes.
Insurrection, I think is the word.
So what?
Insurrection.
Oh, whatever you call
okay,
it. Anyway,
right.
that was only a pinprick compared to what we saw all summer long by those Black Lives Matter thugs that were smashing our cities all to pieces. They smashed their way through to the tune of nearly $500 billion. Every night they were smashing cars, burning businesses, smashing windows, looting, stealing. And guess who was helping support this outfit? It was a Democratic Party. They were funneling money into this, along with George Soros and those other types of guys. And there was one place they showed, I forgot what city it was, I think it was Minneapolis, where they had truckloads of bricks. They were parked there so these thugs could get these bricks.
Jeff, I'm going to ask you to not use the word thugs. I try to keep this show as respectful as possible.
Well, what would you call them?
All right, Jeff, that's enough. I appreciate you calling, but we're not going to use that kind of language. Now, I just want to make this point to everyone who listens to WDEV and to this show. I appreciate your opinion. I absolutely do. I love your calls. But we are not going to be disrespectful to one another, and we're not going to be disrespectful to other individuals in our communities and around this country. It's that kind of talk. It's that kind of hatred that leads to insurrections in the cities, in Washington, D.C. We've had enough. January 6th should have been the nadir, and we're not going to continue that kind of dialogue on this station and on this show. And I apologize that if that's what you want to talk about, but I think there's enough other things we can connect on and respect each other and talk about. And I think we've proved that over the last 3 months on this show. January 6th was a stain, and we don't ever want to see that happen again in our country. And I do hope that when you do call this show, you will be respected by me, but you'll respect every listener who is listening to this station and to this show. I'm going to go to Duxbury next, and we've got Dee. Hi, Dee.
Hi. This is a friendlier thing to say.
Good.
Right? And I'm concerned, not totally, but I'm a little concerned about the demographics. Mm-hmm. I am... My husband and I adopt our kids. They're all adults. They're out of home. But I wish people would have kids. We need more babies.
Uh-huh.
Really? I mean, we do. And if you look at the Vermont population, we're one of the oldest states.
You're correct.
Yeah, and it's not going to, you know, you can't legislate it, right?
No, you can't.
You can't say, okay, people, start having babies. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I don't know what the solution is.
You are correct. Our rate of having children here is lower than most states in the country. We are getting older, and we are trying to, you know, we do lose a lot of people in their 20s and 30s, but a lot do come back. But Dee, your point is very well made, and it is something that I know Governor Scott has kind of brought up several times, that to be able to afford to pay for the services that we have, we do have to bring in younger people. And or in your case, what you're saying is we need to have more children. So get to it, people.
Right.
Thanks, Dee. Can't legislate that, but we can suggest it. And we might want to play some Barry White now and again and get people in the mood. All right, that's it for today. I want to thank you again, dear listeners. This is the end of our show, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Remember, you can always write in, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to the podcast, wdevradio.com. What do we got next? Common Sense Radio. Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.